much for inviting me. I'm afraid that the subject is not exactly about topological strings. I will use and abuse the word string, but this is not precise, really, because I will not be integrating over metrics or complex structures of two-dimensional surfaces. So this talk deals with topological two-dimensional theories, A models and B models. So this is essentially joint work with Misha Kovanov, and it's based on two papers, and it uses the ideas of this paper by Kovanov, where he introduced the foam in order to categorify the SU3 Homfli polynomial. So, and also you will see that in the discussion of boundary conditions, I'll follow this paper pretty closely. So it turned out that this was well known before. So, and you see, you may find the whole construction rather ugly, but nevertheless, it's an essential part of our categorification of SUN Homfli, so it seems to make sense and to have applications. So let T be a family of similar two-dimensional quantum field theories. So we'll deal with two examples. One is A models. So the closed strings, or the operators that you put at punctures inside the surfaces here, are related. The whole model is determined by a Kähler manifold, and the operators that you insert are related to quantum cohomology. And if you introduce surfaces with boundaries, then what appears is the Foucault-Fleur category. Or Fleur-Foucault. And my second example will be Landau-Ginzburg B models. So that's another class of topological sigma models. They are defined by, roughly speaking, a multivariable polynomial. So this is a multi-index from x1 to xn. And the insertions that the operators that you put at punctures of the surface are elements of the so-called Jacobi ring or Jacobi algebra. I'll define it a bit later. And if you introduce boundaries, then you get a category of matrix factorizations. So you just want to mention it from the outset. So we take a family of such theories. For example, many theories based on different Kähler manifolds, or theories based on different polynomials. And usually these families have two properties, which are almost obvious, so people wouldn't state them. First of all, if you place two theories simultaneously on the same worldsheet, which means you just add their Lagrangians, then what you get is a theory of the same family, and I denote it as cross product, because in the case of A models, putting two A models on the same worldsheet is the same as having one A model with the cross product of Kähler manifolds. See, the path integral goes over the maps from your two-dimensional surface to Kähler manifold. So if you map it to two manifolds, it's the same as mapping to cross product. And in case of these Landau-Ginzburg models, what happens is that the superpotentials, these polynomials, just add up. So you have twice as many variables and the sum. The second property is that if you write a Lagrangian and complex conjugate the two-dimensional variable z, that is, replace z by z bar and vice versa, then what you get is again a Lagrangian of the same class of theories. In case of A models, it will be a Lagrangian of x with conjugated complex structure. In case of B model, a very naive guess would be that you would have to conjugate W. Here there is some danger. Unless you write a Lagrangian and look at it, you may worry that you will get W bar, which would be a bad thing. you would trade an analytic for anti-analytic, which will take you outside of the family. But in fact, what happens is that W stays analytic. After that, you just change a sign in front of it. And to be honest, you have to change the sign of one of the fermionic fields, but that's non-essential. So that's how you trade the complex conjugation of Z. Now, these theories can also be defined on surfaces with boundaries. So, for example, you can put them on an upper half plane, and there is a whole big science about what are the proper boundary conditions. So you need boundary conditions that preserve nice properties of the path integral. So, for example, you want it to stay supersymmetric or conformal or topological. And in case of A models, roughly speaking, an appropriate boundary condition is that when you map the inside points into a Kähler manifold, then this red boundary has to go to a Lagrangian submanifold inside that Kähler manifold. And in case of Landau-Ginzburg theories, a nice formulation of boundary conditions was suggested by Koncevich. There are the so-called matrix factorizations of W. So instead of Lagrangian submanifolds, you deal with this. And I'll explain it a little later in details. But I want to present first a general picture how you can get to this foam thing. It has nothing to do with foam of Nekrasov and Okunkov, by the way. So the word was used many times. So let's pose the following question. Suppose we have more than one half plane, say two, and they're glued together along their boundary. So that's really a weird picture. And you put two theories of that family, one per half plane, and you wonder how you would formulate boundary conditions that would preserve nice properties of the theories. So the most naive suggestion is to formulate them independently for T1 and T2, and that would certainly be fine, except that the gluing would not be noticeable at all. So these would be just theories defined on separate half planes, and why glue them? But generally, you may, in order to find the most general boundary condition that may mix the fields, you use the following trick. You just identify both half planes. See, there is unique analytic identification since they're identified along real line. Just identify them. So having them on these two half planes is the same as having them on the same half plane. So instead of worrying about this, you just find a boundary condition for two theories sitting on the same half plane. But since two theories is the same as one theory, then you just borrow a boundary condition from the cross product. And if this boundary condition doesn't split, as we suggested naively, then the gluing is real. So indeed they feel each other. Sorry. Now, suppose I glue them on opposite sides. See, half plane has complex structure, comes with orientation. So I know whether they come on the same side or on the opposite side just by looking at their orientations. Well, in this case, we use, by the way, this line is called a defect line in that paper that I referred to. So this was interesting to physicists because it describes a defect, something that separates two different theories sitting on one complex plane. So how would you formulate a boundary condition here? The trick is to flip, to use a complex conjugation to map the lower half plane onto the upper half plane. Now this will turn T2 into T2 bar. And now again you reduced it to a well-known problem of finding a boundary condition for one theory. So in the most general case of many half planes coming together, you would reduce it to half plane having some of them in the original form and some of them in complex conjugated form, and you will just write this boundary condition. So in fact, you can find this picture, almost this picture, in this paper. And I would call these red lines, I'd call them seams. So a usual boundary is a particular, a usual boundary of a half plane is a particular case of a seam. You just have one half plane. But unfortunately, you see, this simplicity with which you can handle the question is also bad news, because it tells you that you didn't gain much. Actually, there are some benefits of having this flip trick separate from the following discussion. But essentially, you reduced it to theories on half planes, so why bother gluing half planes if what you get is another half plane? So if you want to, get something new out of it, then you may try to introduce junctions of seams and global structure. So you have to consider something which looks locally like these half planes joined at red lines, but then those red lines may join each other. So this looks ugly, well, ugly and singular. It's almost a CW complex, and usually you think of CW complexes as trading smoothness for topological simplicity. But it seems that, in fact, you can introduce some smoothness on these CW complexes or foam and then put quantum field theories on them. So how would you define this foam? Or, as I said, it's almost a CW complex except for some minor technical details. You see, you can define it by looking at the relation between strings and their world sheets. So if you have a world sheet, then a string is a boundary of an epsilon neighborhood of a point. So for example, if your world sheets are manifolds without boundaries, then all the neighborhood boundaries are circles. So you have closed strings. And if you have an open boundary, then for a point on a boundary, the boundary of epsilon neighborhood will be a segment, so it's an open string. But likewise, you can go back from strings to world sheets by saying that world sheet is a manifold, quote unquote, which is locally a cone of a string that you permit. So if you permit open strings, they're cones or disks. If you permit closed strings, they're cones or disks. If you permit open strings, then they're cones or half disks with a boundary. So then you know what is locally a disk or a half disk. It's a smooth manifold with a boundary. Now, if you permit a graph like this blue one, in addition to open string and to a circle, then what you will get is this CW complex or a what we call a world sheet foam. So you see its local structure is either just a boundary or a boundary at which many sheets join together, or it's a vertex, and again, in the vicinity of the vertex, it looks like a cone of a graph. And of course, I use this as an example. That's the most simple graph you can cook up, perhaps, but you can consider graphs with arbitrary complexity. And here on the side, you have an example of this world sheet. You have three disks which are glued at the central line. So that's a very simple example. So alternatively, you can describe this foam by taking a graph, a red graph, you can call it seam graph, without isolated vertices. Well, you could permit them, but then you would have to say a few more words. And a smooth surface, I assume that it is orientable, not necessarily connected, and with a boundary, which is a disjoint union of circles. And then you pick closed walks on the red graph and glue those circles to closed walks. So here you see you have three closed walks, one, the other, and the third, and you just glued your disks into them. And you assume that every seam edge is used in this gluing, so you do not have edges which are not glued to anything. Now, on this foam, you may introduce complex structure. Well, you need complex structure to write Lagrangians. So this is what should make it palatable and nice and smooth. So what is the complex structure? Well, the complex structure for internal points of of the surface components is defined in the usual way, and a complex structure in the vicinity of seams is defined for identification maps. Remember, we want to identify all these half planes with either upper or lower half plane of standard C. So in the vicinity of each point on the seam, we provide these maps and then define holomorphic functions here as pullbacks of holomorphic functions there. And of course, we demand consistency between these definitions for different points. So that transition maps between overlapping cones will be holomorphic. So the hope is that these foam surfaces endowed with complex structure are as good as Riemann surfaces for what's going on here in general. So that's hopefully it's a generalization of the idea of a Riemann surface. Which one? This one? Yes. These seam surfaces will have different complex structures, same as Riemann surfaces. Riemann surfaces is a particular case of this.
I'm sorry, I should say not the different sheets have different orientation.
Oh yes. But in fact, it doesn't matter, as you will see. So you can define, you can say that this is holomorphic or anti-holomorphic, and it will just flip your theory to the conjugated theory. So that part doesn't matter. You can always consider both. Yes. 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 Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So there is this choice. Again, you want to, when you define theories, I'll say it in a moment, first of all, you want to choose particular complex structures or at least orientations on the connected components of sigma. So indeed, let's make this choice. So we pick orientations on connected components. Yes? Yes? You mean the choice between holomorphic and anti-holomorphic? Of course, it's consistent along the seam. So if it's holomorphic on this side, then it's also holomorphic up there. So along each seam, you know who comes on each side. So again, let's talk in terms of orientations. So you pick every component and you assign some orientation to it. And then when they come to a seam, you know who comes on the left. Well, you know who comes on the same side and you know who comes on opposite sides. Then if you give an orientation to a seam, then you know who is holomorphic and who is anti-holomorphic. So if you pick both orientations on sigma i's and on edges, then you know exactly who is holomorphic and who is anti-holomorphic. No. No. I mean, they will join the way they... Again, the only thing is that you pick some orientations, and then you know how they come to each seam. So to each component, you assign a theory of the family. And to each seam, you assign a boundary condition. But we already know how to do it. We consider the theories which are adjacent to that edge. Well, some of them will have to be complex conjugated. You take their cross product. That's your total theory, quote unquote. And then you pick its boundary condition. You hope that it doesn't split. And so then the gluing is real. Now you want to set up a correlator for this theory. Now here, this data is not sufficient to write a correlator because the Hilbert spaces associated to vertices of the seam graph do not have canonical elements. So usually you see if you have a point inside, then its Hilbert space has a canonical element, so you may ignore the point. You don't have to put to specify operator there. You put identity essentially. And same is for an inside point on the edge. But for vertices, it's the same as if you have a junction on a disk of two different boundary conditions, then you have to specify who sits at the junction. So same way, you also in, for, before you write a correlator, you have to say who sits at those vertices. So you want to know what are the Hilbert spaces or the spaces of operators that you can place at different points. So as we said, a point determines its local graph. And then by a local graph, you should be able to construct a Hilbert space. So two cases are obvious. That's the internal point. Then you have your usual closed string of the theory, or an internal point on a theme. Although its local graph looks unusual, but again, we know from the discussion that this is equivalent to one open string with the with three theories sitting on it. So here we also know what the Hilbert space is. But for vertices, this requires a further study. So that's the first interesting question. What is the Hilbert space associated to a seam vertex? Yes? Well, first of all, in the theories that we consider, there will be only finitely many types of vertices. So you'll consider now a restriction of this. You will say that you admit only such and such theories and such local graphs. So the theories that you'll work with will not contain all of them, but just a certain subclass with certain permitted local graphs. And second, again, this is not totally new. If you have a disk, say in A theory, and this portion of a disk maps to one Lagrangian, and this maps to another one, and well, here is a vertex, and you have to figure out what's the operator sitting there. So this is a particular case of a seam vertex, essentially. And again, you find it ugly because it looks singular. But this seems to be manageable singularity. After all, strings can handle orbifolds. So maybe they can also handle this. I mean, not all singularities are so... So let's take a look at an A model on this seam surface. So to each component, you associate a Kähler manifold. Now, if you decide to switch the complex structure in sigma to call it sigma bar, then you would have to switch from x to x bar. And to an edge, you associate a Lagrangian submanifold sitting in the cross product of Kähler manifolds which are adjacent. Some of them may have to be conjugated if these sheets come on the opposite side. And, well, let's look at a Hilbert space of a local graph. So here is a local graph from a previous picture. Now, the edges come from components of sigma, so the edges are mapped into the Kähler manifolds X. And the vertices, they come from the seams. That's why I pictured them in red. So the vertices must go into Lagrangian submanifolds. So if you contemplate how this would look in a string theory, in a full-blown string theory, this really presents a very funny picture. So D-brains allowed you to have universes sitting inside each other. Now, this allows sort of, it's not exactly parallel universes, but you see, you may think of each edge as an open string living in its own universe, totally disconnected, but they communicate with each other through these boundary conditions. So these universes live separately, but they intersect over D-brain in their cross product. So that would be funny, philosophically. Now, what would be a naive, let's take a cheap shot at a Hilbert space. So naively, usually what happens in those theories, you consider a moduli space of constant maps of that graph, of a local graph. So what would be a constant map? Each edge goes in its own Kähler manifold, so the whole thing goes into the cross product of all three Kähler manifolds, but you have conditions that when you project the cross product of all three to first one, second one, and third one, then you should land into the corresponding Lagrangian submanifolds, and also in the cross product, you should sit in the total cross product, you should sit inside L4. So you have some intersection condition, and that's what your moduli space is. So it's a subspace of the cross product of all the Kähler manifolds associated with all the edges, restricted by the conditions on the vertices. And naively, you would think that the Hilbert space is the cohomology ring of that moduli space. But the warning is that this moduli space may be singular, as was discovered by Kovanov and Greg Cooperberg in one of their papers. See, they came across these constructions of graphs and moduli spaces associated with them, and so they realized that for simple models that they tried, even though, well, actually here is a model. So we finished the discussion of A models with an example. So an example would be some finite set of theories and finite set of vertices, and then every form that would fit. So take an n-dimensional complex structure with fixed Hermitian structure on it, and take as your Kähler manifolds, you take the Grassmannians of that CN. So since this one has Hermitian structure, then these Grassmannians have canonical choice of Kähler structure coming from it. Now, if you have K numbers which add to N, then to this set of numbers, you may associate a subspace in the cross product of all Grassmannians, which is specified by the conditions that the subspaces form an orthogonal decomposition of the whole of the total space. So, for example, if you have a three-dimensional complex space, you may consider three CP2s, their cross product, and impose a condition that the lines are orthogonal to each other. And lo and behold, this turns out to be Lagrangian. Well, I asked various people, well, it's very easy to check that it is a Lagrangian, but I don't know how well known this example is. So Kovanov and Cooperberg had this construction. They just didn't know that it was Lagrangian. They didn't care at that stage. Okay, so then you may make your guess, at least naively, what would be correlator of a foam associated with this model. So say if you restrict to constant maps of foams, you will get some intersection theory of, say, to the foam. You have a cross product of all the involved Grassmannians associated to it. You have lots of conditions of perpendicularity, and you compute the intersections. So I would not speculate more about it because it's a rather complicated theory. It leads to quantum cohomology and stuff. So we better let's try something simpler, which is a B model with Lundell-Ginzburg. So this is as simple as it gets. So for this theory, we can write a complete answer an exact answer for the Hilbert spaces and for the correlators. So, a B model is determined by, let's assume, by a polynomial of many variables, and the space of closed rings is so-called Jacobi algebra. It's the quotient of all the polynomials by the ideal generated by all partial derivatives. So for good choices of W, this is finite dimensional, so it's nice. So if you take a Riemann surface of genus G and you place M such polynomials at punctures, then this is a setup for a correlator for path integral, And a nice formula was provided by Kumron Vafa, and it's given by contour integral. It's a certain n-dimensional, real n-dimensional contour around, well, an appropriate one. You take the product of these polynomials, multiplied by the contribution of the handles, so to say, divide by partial derivatives and integrate. So there is a formula which computes it. Now, if your surface has boundaries, then the question becomes more complicated. So physicists spend some time formulating boundary conditions, and I think the easiest formulation was suggested by Koncevich. So he suggested that a boundary condition may be specified by choice of matrix factorization of W. So what is this matrix factorization? You take a Z2 graded rank MM free CX model. In other words, you take a space with M ordinary and M Grassmannian coordinates, and you think of it as a vector space, but only over polynomials, roughly speaking. So it's a very pedestrian way to say it. I shouldn't maybe mention it. So it's a direct sum. And you look for an endomorphism of this space of degree 1, so it will map bosons to fermions and vice versa, and the main condition is that its square must be equal to W. So you cannot factor W over polynomials. Maybe you can factor it over matrices with polynomial entries. So that's the idea. So in other words, you have a map from bosonic subspace to fermionic subspace and from fermionic to bosonic, and both ways you compose them, you should get W times identity. That's how D looks if you split it into block diagonal form. Maps this way. So what is a Hilbert space, an operator space for an open string in this case? So you have this half plane. Here lives a theory determined by the polynomial W. Now on negative part of real line lives this matrix, one matrix factorization of W. On the other side lives another one. Note that I marked the orientation of the segments of the boundary. So look at the linear maps from the total module M1 to the total module M2. So they're linear over the whole ring. And there is a special operator that acts on the space of these maps. This operator is defined as a commutator of the map from M1 to M2 with D, which acts in each module. Of course, this is an abuse of notation, writing it like this. So what it literally means is this. It's a supercommutator, in fact. So you have this extra, and you have to put D1 and D2 on both sides because these are different spaces. But still, it's a commutator. Now, an easy thing to check is that it squares to zero. So that's the key observation here, is that although this D doesn't square to zero, so it doesn't look like a differential, on Holmes, you do have a differential. It follows from Jacobi identity. If you apply D twice to O, that's the same as half of the anti-commutator of D with itself commuted with O. But anti-commutator of D with itself is W, and W commutes with everyone. So that's how you get the zero. So since this operator acting on Holmes is a differential, then you can just take its homology. So you define the space of operators as the ones that commute with D factored, quotiented by the ones which are commutators with D. And in categorical language, this is the space of morphisms if you think of these matrix factorizations as objects. So you have a category of all matrix factorizations of a fixed potential W, and the morphisms there are these spaces. So this is about 2 or 3 years old. It was picked up by Kapustin and Lee and other people after Koncevich's suggestion, and a theory was developed. So first of all, let me mention that there is an alternative description of this space. So we described it as Holmes cohomology of forms considered as with that differential. You can describe it alternatively if you use a notion of tensor product of matrix factorizations. So suppose you have two matrix factorizations of two different polynomials of the same variables or different variables, it doesn't matter. So naturally you want to take tensor product of the modules, and you treat D as if it were a differential. So if you take a tensor product of two complexes, then the differential and the tensor product would be the sum of differentials, but you have to be careful about signs, of course. So you have to be careful. It's not exactly what I wrote it, up to some sign things. Now, the funny thing is that if you square this D1 plus D2, then what will you get? You will get D1 squared, which is W1, D2 squared, which is W2, and you will also get a commutator, you will get an anti-commutator. A plus B squared is A squared plus B squared plus anti-commutator of A and B, but it's a super anti-commutator. So since D1 and D2 are fermionic, so in fact you will get a commutator, but they commute since they act on different spaces. So this middle term drops out, so you're left with W1 and W2. So when you take a tensor product, then the potentials add up. So that's a nice feature. So now you can define a dual matrix factorization, which would be a matrix factorization of the opposite potential with the dual module and dual differential defined like this. So then the basic property of the dual matrix factorization is that this tensor product of M2 with dual of M1 should give you the same as Holmes from M1 to M2, which we had on the previous transparency. So indeed, you see, you get the cross product, which is the same as Holmes over C of X. Now you have the sum of differentials, and note that the potentials will add to zero because the actual potential of this one is negative W, according to this. So this thing, again, squares to zero, and so you can take its cohomology. So the picture now, which corresponds to this approach, is arrows going outside. So you see I reversed this arrow, and I had to replace the matrix factorization by its dual, naturally. So now they both exit, so instead of taking home, I take a tensor product. Now, Kapustin and Lee derived a nice formula for the boundary state corresponding to this boundary condition. In other words, if you have a Riemann surface and it has this red boundary, then you can replace this for the purpose of computing correlators by a cap. So you cut along the circle and you just place a cup. And in that cup, you have to insert a certain operator from the Jacobi algebra, which would mimic what goes on here. So naively, you would think, since these operators are Holmes, you can naturally compose them and just take super trays. So that would be the most naive guess. But Kapustin and Lee used some path integral arguments to show that you have to add one extra piece. See, you have pick up one of these three modules, doesn't matter which, say M1, take the differential of that M1, take all its partial derivatives over the variables x, and anti-symmetrize the product. Also, there should be 1 over n factorial here, which I missed. And insert it into this. So there is this technical important fact, and they claim that this is the boundary state. So now we have all the ingredients to compute, to put it on a foam and compute correlators. So to each piece, you associate its own variables and its own polynomial. Now, to an edge, you associate a matrix factorization of the sum of polynomials which are adjacent, and you also have to observe the signs, because if a certain world sheet comes on the opposite side, then you have to take its polynomial with minus, because it's a conjugated theory after you flip. And if you reverse an or, again, you, also when you do this association, E has to be oriented, because if you reverse an orientation of E, then you have to go from matrix factorization to conjugated matrix factorization, to the dual matrix factorization. So what would be a Hilbert space of a local graph? Well, now it's very easy to give. So to each edge you associate a potential, to each vertex you associate a matrix factorization coming from that same edge. Take a tensor product of these four matrix factorizations. In other words, cross product of matrix factorizations of all vertices. The potentials will add up to zero, because you see each potential appears with opposite signs at opposite vertices of at the adjacent vertices of the edge. So you just take the differential and there you are. So the Hilbert space of a vertex would just be this thing. So now you can write a boundary state of a seam graph. So what would be a boundary state of a seam graph? So the idea is similar. You want to cut the seam graph out of that foam with its tubular neighborhood. So what will be left? There will be pieces of sigma with the holes, with the boundary. And you want to put the operators into those holes that would mimic the effect of the seams with all the vertices on them. So you look at all these closed walks to which the boundary of sigma is attached. So you leave only a thin strip of sigma going around. Now you pick one edge for each closed walk and place there the sum of the alternated product of derivatives of D with respect to the variables of that component of sigma, just of that component, just pick, it doesn't matter which edge. And then you see to this edge you have a module associated to it which will enter this vertex as M, but this vertex, since it's ingoing, it will enter as M star. So in the tensor product associated to this vertex, it's M, and here it's M star. So if you place the operators at the vertices, then you have a natural pairing along all edges. So you pair them all up, including these Kapustin-Lee operators inserted at some edges. And you get an element of the product of all the Jacobi rings. So that's what your boundary state is. So then you apply Waffa's formula over each connected component of sigma, and you get, yes? And you get your total correlator. Over all the holes. You see, let me back up. So this thing is a gluing of a seam graph with sigma which has holes in it. In other words, let me say it again. How do you get a fold? You take a seam graph and you take sigma with holes, and you glue the boundaries of the holes. No. You have to disconnect. You want to disconnect sigma from the. Sorry, you want to disconnect your surface from the seam graph. You want to replace seam graph by caps, which you put into the holes of sigma. So there will be no seam graph, but there will be caps with punctures. Right? Again. Let me back up. What's the idea of this computation? Yes. Oh, sure. Yeah. So here we had a seam graph with three disks. So what you had here is so you cut this out. You cut this out, Well, I should have marked what is left. So you leave a strip here, you leave a strip there, just to remind you how it is glued, and you leave a strip over there.
Okay. So the state you're looking for is in the tensor product.
Yes, of the circles, and yes, and that goes into the sigma. You just take scissors and cut a tubular neighborhood of the seam graph. And what you're left with is sigma with holes. So you remove the gluing. So you want to plug the holes by caps. And what do you put at caps? The thing that you put lives in the tensor product of all the Jacobi algebras associated with all the caps. So the formula is this, right? So this pairing lives in the cross product of all the Jacobi algebras. Yes, you take a super. Well, super trace means pairing. It's equivalently. That's why I gave that alternative description of. So, let me just add here. So this is basically what I wanted to say. So let me add few more details to this. You see, the theory of open strings is associated to categories. So people call these boundary conditions, they are objects of a category, and the Hilbert space of a string that connects them is the space of morphisms in that category. So you may think of objects, let me draw them a bit differently, not as points, but rather as points with small arrows attached to them, and then this is a morphism. So now let's see what we have in the case of graph strings. So here, your object, rather than a point with an arrow, looks like a point, a vertex with three arrows coming out of it, for example. So that's an object, which is a matrix factorization of this potential. Now, here is another one, which is a matrix factorization of this potential. Now, if you glue the edge, this corresponds to tensoring these matrix factorizations. As you see, W3 cancels out together with its variables. See, it carried. So again, the important feature of this is that it's a matrix factorization of the sum of three potentials, each depending on its own variables. So all the variables in the third list are canceled in this matrix factorization. So this is an object of matrix factorizations of this potential. So here you could glue objects into morphisms. Here you glue objects and you get another object. So it's a bit richer categorical structure than. Yes. 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 No, because you take this tensor product over C of X3, so you identify them. I should have written over C of X3. Yeah, that's an excellent observation that Misha. Yes. It's an excellent observation. It disappeared from the potential. So you can still claim that this thing, well, it is a Landau-Ginzburg theory of this potential. The only problem is that this module has infinite rank because there is X3 sitting inside it. The good news is that if the Jacobi algebra of W3 is finite dimensional, then you can contract it. over x1, x2, x4, and x5. So you ignore the CX3 structure, and you can contract to something of finite rank.
That's what you mean by the
new object. Yes, so it will be an honest, so provided that... Sorry? Well, I do not impose, yes? No, no. The only condition here for this to work nicely is that Jacobi algebra of W3 is finite dimensional. So in that case, this infinite dimensional rank module, it has infinite rank because there is X3 sitting in there. It's 3 over X3, the way it's written. But now you forget about the X3 structure, and you can contract them. So most pieces of X3 will drop out. And so this one is equivalent to a finite rank factorization over the outgoing variables. So it's a fact. Well, same way, compare it to the fact that when you consider closed strings, it's not all the polynomials, but the quotient, which is the Jacobi ring. So you have seen this reduction to finite dimensional. So this is something similar. So this phenomenon of contracting to finite rank is similar to going from all polynomials to the Jacobi ring, which is a finite dimensional. So all polynomials are infinite dimensional, but the Jacobi ring hopefully is finite dimensional if we have a nice polynomial.
Can you think the tensor field
over W3 cancel with W3? This is exactly what happens. You see this leg is incoming. Oh, I should have written here plus W3, because it's incoming with plus W3, which means outgoing with minus W3. It's the same thing. So it should have been plus here. I'm sorry. So in the tensor product, so this is a matrix factorization of X4 plus X5, but minus X3, because it's incoming. So this also allows you to consider this matrix factorization as a functor. So not only is it an object, it's also a functor from these matrix factorizations to these matrix factorizations. So it's both an object and a functor. So it's a rich structure, which Dror Barnaton gave it a... Well, not for the case of the graph strings, but for the case of ordinary surfaces with boundaries, he described this nice structure and called it canopoly, from the word canned vegetables. So he takes pieces of surfaces and puts them in cans, and then cans can be composed in two ways. Either you stack them up on top of each other, or you put them sideways. So I refer to his paper. And of course, this also suggests that the Foucault-Flora category should have some similar structure, right? Because this is not restricted to just to Landau-Ginzburg B-models. So you would expect these Lagrangian submanifolds in cross products of Taylor manifolds to serve as also as functors. But again, that's hard case. So let me finish with a particular example of. Now this is a bit technical, but on the other hand, that's what we used in the categorification of Homfli. So this is an example of Landau-Ginzburg theories, which behaves almost like that example with Grassmannians, except that it is calculable. So you can get with some simple algebra, you can get all the answers. So let me first introduce some notation. Suppose you have two polynomials, then let this denote a very simple matrix factorization of rank 1-1. It's a multiplication by P and then multiplication by Q. So you get a multiplication of PQ this way. So if your polynomial factors, then you have a matrix factorization corresponding to it. Now, if your polynomial is a sum of products, then you can take a tensor product of these simple factorizations corresponding to each term in the sum. And since the potentials add, then you will get a factorization of W. So this is more or less how Dirac constructed his matrix factorization for which he got his fame. So x1, x2 plus x3, x4. That's a simple polynomial. Now, consider, this is a bit technical, but you may find these formulas in a paper by Witten about a correspondence between the quantum cohomology ring of Grassmannians and the Ferlinghi algebra of UN. So that's where we got them. So consider this polynomial, which depends on parameters P. It's a polynomial of T. And let's expand it in powers of T and pick the term at the n plus first power. So the coefficient will be a polynomial in all these P tildes. Now, if you count the powers of T, say you assign degree 1 to this one and degree n to that one, and count the degree, the total degree of this one should be n plus 1. So how can you cook up a monomial of degree n plus 1 out of variables with degree 1, 2, 3, up to n? Obviously, every monomial should be proportional to at least one variable whose degree is less than n plus 1 over 2. Because if you have only variables whose degree is greater than half, then you cannot add them up to get the total. Each individual is less than total, but a sum of two is more. So you need at least one of them. So this allows you to present this P as a sum of products of these first half variables times the polynomials of the other ones, of all of them, in fact. So this gives you a matrix factorization of this polynomial of P tildes for this construction. So you presented it as a sum of product. Now, you consider a similar expression, but in this case, you have variables from x1 to xn. This is the nth set of variables. And you stop them at a lesser degree of t, and you pick a potential, again, at that same power, t to the n plus 1. So the claim that you can verify is that if the sum of these n's is equal to n, and you take the product of these expressions, then since the total degree adds up to n, you can write it as this one, with t going up to n. Now these coefficients p tilde become polynomials in all these x's. If you take these expressions and substitute them into C, then you will get the sum of these W's. That's basically logarithm of a product is a sum of logarithms. That's the property that goes into it. So then you take this matrix factorization with these substitutions. And that provides you a matrix factorization of the sum of these potentials, Wn, if the sum of n is equal to this n total. So why is this interesting? So suppose you consider a local graph. So you have to orient them somehow and assign these matrix factorizations so that they will add up to n correctly at the vertices and compute the Hilbert space. Now, this whole thing is quasi-homogeneous, so this Hilbert space has a grading coming from the powers of the variables x. Now, replace the Wn factorizations with the nth wedge power of the fundamental representation of Sun, then this condition exactly guarantees that you can put an invariant tensor here. See, they are all skew symmetric coming in, so you take the whole skew symmetric thing, which is an invariant. So now it looks like an invariant constructed out of representations of Vn. So this theory of Chern-Simons assigns to these things a polynomial in Q. So that would be home flight polynomial of this graph. One has to specify a few more things here, but nevertheless. And that's a polynomial in Q. So the claim is that this polynomial will be exactly the graded dimension of this Hilbert space. So there is this funny correspondence that enters into the categorification construction of Homfli. So indeed, these theories seem to have right to life and appear in interesting places. So I wonder if this could be extended to other theories and with metric in them and complex structure in them.